Hello, everybody. We are up to Shmuel Bet Perek Chet, Chapter 8. If you recall, last week, I mentioned that according to some commentaries, Chapter 7 is out of order. Perek Zion begins with a description of peace in Israel that fits the template that you find in three psukim in Sefer Devarim that speaks of Israel and as a time and a place where they are freed from all around them, from all their enemies, right? Right? You sound familiar, right? From Parshas Zohar with Amalek. So that template appears in the beginning of chapter 7 in Shmuel Bet, we did last week. And that's why David wanted to build the Beis HaMikdash. That is a condition for building the Beis HaMikdash. So why would I say that chapter 8 is out of place? Because chapter 8, he's fighting wars again. Okay? If it seems that if David wanted to follow that template and the author of Shmuel wanted to introduce David's willingness or desire to build God a temple with the very, very famous and very familiar template I just described, surely there shouldn't be so many wars to fight. This whole chapter, he's fighting more wars against the Philistines, against the Moabites, right? Therefore, some commentaries place chapter 8 before chapter 7, and then we obviously have to ask the following question. Why? Why put chapter 8 here when we should have had it before? So on one level, I think an answer, a very quick answer, presents itself, because we wanted chapter 7 to be juxtaposed to chapter 6. Chapter 6 is where David brought the Aron back from the house of Avinadav, where it had been for 20 years, 20 years after the Philistines took it and sent it back. So David wants to bring it back, and now that I have the Aron, I have to have a holy city to put it in. So the Tanakh juxtaposes those two stories, even though there were some wars to be fought in between, and those wars are now described in chapter 8. Okay, fine. Okay, according to this Cheshbon then, chapter 7 is right before chapter 9. And that will explain something very interesting. I do intend this evening to do both chapter 8 and 9, or at least to start chapter 9 tonight. They're both relatively small chapters. And if I am telling you that chapter 7 is after chapter 8, that means the correct order of Shmuel Bet is, get this, chapter 6, 8, 7, 9. Okay? 6, 8, 7, 9. Why was 7 put out of its place? Again, I suggest to you, in order to juxtapose the story of the return of the Aron, remember where tragedy struck Uzzah, that if the Tanakh wants to juxtapose the story of the return of the Aron with David wanting to put it someplace and build a house for it. So 7 was taken from a later spot and juxtaposed to 6. Okay, but the true order is 6, 8, 7, 9. And let's just go into the text and I'll bring that point up shortly. Okay. Vahi acharechein vayach David es plishtim vayachniyem vayikach David es meseg ha'amam yad plishtim. So this looks like just right after chapter 5, actually. Right? Chapter 5 is where it says that David fought the Plishtim and that they didn't give him any trouble anymore. Remember, we discussed this 3-4 weeks ago, that after David was crowned the unequivocal king of all of Israel, now that Ish-bosheth is out of the way, so the Philistines tried to go to war with this newly minted king. The people of Tzor to the north were smarter. They realize that David is a very powerful king. It serves our best interests to make peace with him. Sounds like the story of the Middle East today, right? What pathologies attach themselves to all these Arab countries who couldn't resolve themselves to the fact of a small, tiny Jewish presence in their midst. And they're spending 60, 70 years just ruining their nations out of their hatred of Israel. That's what the Plishtim did in chapter 5. And then you hardly, barely hear from them again in all of Sefer Melachim. So it says in chapter 5 that David made short shrift of them. And here they are again in chapter 8, because this is from an earlier time. And David took it says, Veikach David es meseg ha'ama miyad plishtim. Other different opinions about what this was. And most commentaries say it's some kind of bejeweled and bedecked object of great value. Okay. Now the next pasuk is profoundly cruel, especially cruel. We don't see any time that David acts with this kind of cruelty. There is a story like this where in Sefer Melachim, where Edomites in captivity are killed. But just this is just the cruelty of this next pasuk makes Rashi ask the question: what could explain David's profound cruelty to his own nation, Moab? It's his great grandparents, right? Vayachas Moab vayimadeid b'chevel hashkeim osam arza vayimadeid shnei chabolim lahamis umlo hachevel lahachios vati Moab leDavid lavadim nosem mincha. So what he did was he captured many Moabites. And it says Hashkevo Samarza. He put them down, possibly tied up on the ground, and he killed every two of them, and then the third one he let live to be captive. Then he killed the next two and let the third one live. Killed the next two and let the third one live. It's very cruel to do the captives, right? So Rashi says, why did he do this? So there is certainly an act of vengeance. If you recall, back in Shmuel Aleph, David realized that Shaul was making a good example of anybody who dared help him. But David had no place to go for food. Anyone who would offer him food, David would be putting that whole city in grave danger. Remember what Shaul did to the Kohanim who helped David. But then David realized that his own family is in grave danger, because Shaul would take all of his siblings and his parents and say, I'm going to kill each one of these one by one, David, unless you give yourself up. Right? So David took his entire family and he brought them to the king of Moab. This is not Medrash, this is in Shmuel Aleph. He took him to the king of Moab and he said, I need my family to stay here. Obviously Moab, because that's his background outside of Israel. His great-grandmother was Ruth from Moab. And David said, when it is safe, I will call for you and I will bring you back home. Now, not everything needs to actually be written in the Bible. But the fact is, nowhere in Shmuel Bet does David call for them. And in fact, Chazal say that the king of Moab killed every last one of them except one sister who survived. Her name was Abigail. And the king of Ammon saved her. That king's name was Nachash. Remember, you don't remember yet because we haven't done it yet, but in chapter 10 of this book, David is going to send a delegation when that king died to his son, Hanun. We'll see all about that. Okay, possibly next week if I get everything done here. All right, so this explains David's profound cruelty against the Moabites because they had killed his entire family. All right, still another war. Vati Moav, it says, Vayach David es Hadadezer ben Rechov Melech Tzoba b'lechto la'ashiv yado b'nahar pras. So David subdued three nations, Plishtim, Moav, and Tzoba is Aram, Syria. Right? Keter Aram Tzoba, Aleppo Codex. Tzoba is Aleppo. So David subdued these three nations. Okay. And when he subdued them, he took the chariots, right? He burnt the wood of the chariots. He took the horses, and it says, "Va'yakir David is kol harechev." David, he captured 20,000 soldiers and 1,700 chariots. He saved 100 chariots in case he needs it for another war. But imagine this is really, he's here. The other nations fight their battles with horses and chariots. I fight in the name of gods. David does not need all these 1,700 chariots. He destroys them. And it says, the Hebrew word is Vayaker David is called Harechev, right? So that means that he uprooted all of the chariots, but he also, we'll see shortly, he did the same to the horses, right? Now, this also appears in Sefer Yehoshua, because Yehoshua also captured many horses, many, many chariots. Remember, the Torah prohibits an overabundance of horses. It's ironic that Shlomo, who didn't have to fight any wars, certainly not in the beginning of his reign, had 40,000 stables of horses, contravening the Torah's law of not having too many of those. Right? But an ikur of susim is to be done, says the Gemara, since tzar bali chayim is a Torah law, not allowed to cause undue pain to an animal. So it just means that he would cut the hoof in a certain way that would render the horse incapable of serving as a war effort. The horse could still ride with a human on top of him, but he wouldn't be worthy as a war vehicle. Yeah, I don't want to use these things as for any battles. Okay. All right, so it says that David continued to fight against the Arameans. And it's just almost a side note. This takes us all the way up to verse 8, that David totally subdued the Arameans. And in Aram, there were mountains where brass and copper were mined. And it says that David took very much brass and copper from these places because it's sort of foreshadowing that he would need it for the Beis HaMikdash. Beis HaMikdash had a lot more brass than gold and silver. Okay. All right. So there's some really, really minute details in this chapter 8. And it's really a chapter of detail, as you'll see through and through. And it tells of a king named To'i, the king of Hamas. Hamas is a country up to the north, right? Okay. He called David as Kol Chel Hadadezer, but Yishlach To'i as Yoram Beno, Melch David, Lish'olo Lishalom, Levarcho al Asher Nocham Babadadezer, by Akehu. Ki Yishmil Hamos To'i Hayu Hadadezer, Yadoha Yukol Kesev Uklei Zahav Uklei Nechoshes. This guy To'i, a very huge pasuk here, was very thankful to David and brought gifts. And this is a harbinger for all the gifts that everyone would bring to David and to Shlomo to be on their good side. Right? All of a sudden, now everyone wants to be on David's good side. Nothing works like success. So this king named To'i, Tafayin Yud, you can see a pasuk Tesin Yud, was very thankful to David for subduing his traditional enemy. In the framework of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, right? Hadadezer is my enemy. David is Hadadezer's enemy, so David and I should be friends, and they did make a peace pact. Okay, so what did David do with all gold and silver and brass that he received as gifts? Gamosam hikdish hamelech David l'Hashem im hakesef azav asher hikdish mikol hagoyim asher kibesh. David conquered many people. And again, this is before chapter 7, because chapter 7 begins, David finished fighting all his wars. Okay? All right, full disclosure, there will be other wars, but that's for separate reasons. Okay? Me'aram, me'moav, me'bnei Amon, me'plishtim, me'amalek, me'shlal hadadezer, ben rechov, melech tzova. Wait a second, it seems to say in this pasuk that David took brass, gold, silver, and other spoils from all these nations, and one of them is Amalek. How could that be? Shaul taking spoils from Amalek brought down his kingdom. And here this pasuk seems to be saying that together with all these other nations, David took spoils from Amalek. Anybody here have an answer for this? David did fight a war against Amalek at the end of Shmuel Aleph. The spoils he took, which are described there, were his own. Right? Amalek had conquered David's camp.
It was another nation. It wasn't theirs.
Right. Well, it was David's own. David had 600 men and their families traveling with him. And Amalek, while David was away dealing with Shaul, Amalek captured all of those, the families of those 600 men, and took the spoils of the Jews. When it says David took the spoils of Amalek, it means he took back what the Amalekim took from him. Okay? How do we know from the Torah that you're not allowed to take spoils from Amalek? We did that, remember we did last year in the Haftorahs. Is because it says Timche et Zecher Amalek, and the Sifrei darshins the word as if though it's Zecher Amalek, which means no reminder of Amalek. Don't take anything from them because that will remind you of Amalek. Okay? So it's as if though it's like a Torah law not to take the spoils from Amalek. Okay? Says Vayas David Shem b'shuvo me'akoses Aram b'gei Melech Shmona Asar Elef. It's a very famous pasuk because this pasuk is written in Divrei Hayamim and in Tehillim. There's a parak in Tehillim that begins, and in each of these three places, there's a different number. I'm not going to try to resolve this for you. The Radak just says it refers to three different parts of the same story in which different amounts of people were conquered. But I don't know. But one thing is very clear. This chapter is filled with cases of David continuing to fight battles. I reiterate again. How could this be after a chapter that said David finished fighting all his battles? Okay, you get it? Okay. So it says that Bayoshev Edom Nitzivim Bechol Edom, some Nitzivim. Excuse me. Vayhi Kol Edom Avodim LeDavid Bayosha Hashem Es David Bechol Asher Halach. Whatever David fought, he won. And David set up like governors of Edom to be in charge. And not until the middle of Sefer Melachim Bet do we find that the Edomites rebelled and appointed their own kings. Okay. Now, here is a very interesting contrast. I told you that this is a chapter all about details and just minutiae, right? What occurs, we're already up to Pasuk Tesvav. What occurs from this point on to the rest of the Perek is David's cabinet, right?
His what?
Cabinet. The people who helped him run the country.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that starts with the pasuk Vayimloch David Al Kol Yisrael Vayhi David Osem Mishpat Utzdakah L'Chol Amo, because the purpose of his cabinet is just that, to run a country that is guided by tzedakah u'mishpat. Of course, you have to pave roads. You have to have some safe safety. That you have to make sure that anyone in your entire nation is safe from border incursions from other nations. Maybe you should also involve yourself to make sure people have fresh water, right? There were water pools all over, especially on the journey to Jerusalem. Make sure people had ample water. So, yeah, there's some things, depending on your politics. We want the government to, just do a few important things and try to just stay out of my business, right? And that is actually a political point I think can be made between Shmuel Bet Perek Chet and Melachim Aleph Perek Dalid. If you can look at Melachim Aleph Perek Dalid while I'm telling you this, you'll see a profound contrast. is that the rest of this parak, just three psukim, says, V'yoav ben Tsruya al Hatzava. Yoav, the son of David's sister Tsruya, was in charge of the army. Yehoshaphat ben Achilud Mazkir. A good government needs record keeping. Right? There's a Mazkir. There's a keeper of the history. Right? The Tzadok ben Achituv, Vachimelech ben Evyatar Kohanim. Remember, this is a theocracy after all. Right? An Israelite society is many things. It's a monarchy. They have a king. It's a theocracy. Right? It's also a democracy. Shoftim b'shotrim titein lecha. We choose our legislators. We choose our judiciary. Okay? And there must be a separation of these powers. Okay? We learned this many times already, that what angered Shmuel when they asked for a king was that they said, Tna lanu melech l'shofteinu. Give us a king to be a judge. No. That's giving too much power. Famous Drasha Saran, Drasha Yad Aleph. It's giving the king too much power. Never works well when kings in Tanakh try to judge. One or two cases here and there, yeah, the king can hurrah a shah, it's called, could come forth with an emergency dispensation. But when the king starts to put on the robe and judge, it does not go well. Just as much as when the king puts on the Kohen Gadol garb and wants to be the religious leader, it also doesn't go well. The king's in charge of making sure those institutions work well. But once he tries to misharayin, then it doesn't go well. Okay? It's Tzadok, so he has Tzadok and Achimelech.
Rabbi?
Yes, question?
Then what is the king's main purpose in times of peace if he doesn't judge?
His main purpose is to som tosim alecha shetahei maso alecha. Mara says it very clearly. It's that every person and every leader below him should, that he has to put the fear of God in them to stay in line. To make sure there's law and order. I think the Pasuk here says it very well. Right? Pasuk Tezvav.
So he's administrative.
Vayhi David oseh mishpatut tzedakah cholamo. Now, what's oseh mishpatut tzedakah means, you know, he's performing, he's promulgating justice and charity. Right? Okay. And then it says that Ubenayahu ben Yehoyada, the Akresi v'haplesi, Uvnei David hay, Kohanim hayu. Strange pasuk. What's the crazy and the placey? Right? So, if you have an English translation with you, sometimes crazy and placey are translated as archers and slingers. Is that what you have? The Gemara in Bracha says the crazy and the placey were those in charge of the Urim V'Tumim. But why do I need Benayahu ben Yehoyada for that? I already mentioned the two Kohanim. Right? Now only one of them could be the Kohen Gadol. Right? I'm just saying it makes sense that it's archers and slingers. One, because Benayahu ben Yehoyada seems to, in other places in Tanakh, before and after this Pasuk, have a role in the army. Especially in the beginning of Melachim Aleph. Okay. And none of these cabinet members did ever say anything about the army yet. So that's here. Well, it says Yoav ben Tsruya al Hatzava, I should say. But Yoav fights after someone consults the Urim V'Tumim. Right? What is this with Nate David Kohanim Hayu? David's sons were Kohanim? What does that mean? Right? Right? Can David from Shevet Yehuda just by fiat make his sons to be Kohanim? So whenever you see a pasuk like this, the place you go to first is the Targum. Okay? Targum renders Kohanim as leaders. Okay? There are four different Targumim for Kohanim in the Torah. If you're a descendant of Aharon, the Targum is going to be Kahanaya. You're a minister to God. If you are the father-in-law of Moshe or Yosef, sound familiar? Kohen On or Kohen Midyan? You are a Rav. You're a leader. Like this pasuk here. Apparently Targum, this is Targum Unculus. Targum did not want Moshe and Yosef marrying the daughter of idolatrous priests. They were not Kohen, like Kohen On. They were leader of On. If you are Malki Tzedek in Parshas Lech Lecha, the Targum is like a shamus, a minister. And the only representation of the word Kohen in the Torah where we are talking about an idolatrous priest and yet the Torah uses the word Kohen is in, anybody? This week's Parsha. This coming week's Parsha. Sound familiar? It's where Paro, when he was purchasing everyone's land,
except for his priests,
food, it says, except for his priests. And the Torah uses the word, the Kohanim of Egypt. Those are idolatrous priests. Okay? But that's the only time in the Torah where the word Kohen is used, where it's not either a descendant of Aharon or some kind of other, you know, worthwhile
Rabbi, I read just recently that when they would go to war, there was a Kohen Gadol appointed to go to lead them to war, who was not the Kohen Gadol who ministered in the temple, who with the Aaron or for the.
This is correct. The name of that person in the Gemara, it's a Gemara in Maseches Sota. In the seventh parak, it's called the Kohen Mashuach Milchama. He's also anointed. His death will also allow someone in a city of refuge to go to leave. Even if the Kohen Gadol who works on Yom Kippur and works in the temple is still alive. You're right. There's more than one Kohen Gadol at a particular time, but he's called Mashuach Milchama. He also must marry a Basula. Right, he also can't go to siblings and parents' funerals. He's like a nazir in that respect. But of course, if what you're saying is maybe that's Benayo ben Yahuyada, who is with the slingers and the archers, so he goes to war with them, and the other guys were, you know, a different kind of con. Yeah, it's very possible. It would make sense. Okay, now what's the contrast with Malachim Aleph Perek Daled? Anybody look that up while I was saying all this? Malachim Aleph Perek Daled lists Shlomo HaMelech's cabinet. It's a whole perek. You see what contrast I'm making? Do you remember what brought down Shlomo's kingdom?
Too much government.
Right. Or in one word, taxes.
Taxes, right.
I mean, they said so. They said, lower the taxes and we'll serve you.
Yeah. Said, no, raise them.
He said, I'm going to raise them. So, okay, he said, well, okay, we'll go to Florida. What do you want? It's nicer weather there. All right, so there's just so much we could take. All right, so that's really what you know, you see the difference here. David says, okay, I have a kingdom. I can run it with about five good people. I can run a kingdom. And Shlomo, you know, has like 473 people helping him out, right? Remember, Very few people know about this movie. It's called The 12 Chairs. Have you ever heard of it?
12 Chairs?
12 Chairs. You should see it. Anyway, I could see Yakov Gorodetsky is going to enjoy this movie. It's Mel Brooks' first movie, and it's about the Russian Revolution and how a family, seeing the handwriting on the wall, hide the family jewels in 12 dining room chairs. But the Bolsheviks come in and they confiscate everything, including the 12 chairs. So only one person knows about the jewels, and she confesses on her deathbed to her priest, who's played by Dom DeLuise, that she hid the jewels in the 12 chairs. So he starts looking for them. And the whole movie is about the word spreads about where these 12 chairs are. And everyone, it's like the mad world, sort of, where everyone's looking for these 12 chairs. Anyway, there's a scene where someone finally finds the Russian warehouse where the 12 chairs are kept. And they're looking for different rooms in the warehouse. You have the bureau for dining room sets. The bureau for, you know, there's like 20 different bureaus in this particular building for everything, you know, because the Russian government has to have someone in charge of every little thing, right? And then finally she sees a room called the Bureau for Bureaus. And then finally they end up finding the chairs, only to find out that the jewels were ransacked the day they were taken. But the whole movie is a spoof on the Russian system of government, which could be a spoof on Malach HaMalach, Perek Daled. All right? Okay, so if you ever have a chance, the 12 Chairs, it's his first movie and many think his best. So that's the contrast between Shmuel Bet, Perek Chet, which was a successful government, and kept small, and the sort of cradle to grave kind of situation that Shlomo was working on for the people. But please don't take such good care of us, right? You're taking too good care of us. We you're just and they rebelled against it. Okay, all right. Now remember, if chapter 8 is before chapter 7. Then one has to wonder what makes chapter 9 all of a sudden David wake up one day and say what he says in the beginning of this chapter. Yema David, Achiyesh od asher nosar lebeis Shaul ve'esei mocheset bavur Yehunasan. Is there anyone left from the house of Shaul that I can look after? Because I made a pact with Yehunasan about that. Now, in truth, David made a pact with Shaul about that. And Yonasan. Why doesn't he mention Shaul here? Well, because Shaul went back on that.
Yeah, he broke it.
He broke that pact. So David's not bound by that pact. But he is bound by the pact he made with Yonasan. Remember where they parted ways with the arrows, the Haftarah of Machar Chodesh, right? When Rosh Chodesh falls on a Sunday. You all remember that story, right? So David made a pact with Yonasan that he'll always look after, him and Yonasan's descendants, right? He also made that promise to Shaul, right? And Shaul told him, promise me that you won't kill my children when you become king. David sort of let, you know, he always, whenever he was confronted with such a statement, he would always tell Shaul, how many times do I have to tell you? I don't intend to become king. Right? But instead, this time David let up his guard and he said, okay, Shaul, I promise. So Shaul told his men, I told you.
Trap.
So Shaul started chasing after him again. Right, so David owes nothing to Shaul, but he does owe a promise to Yonasan to look after Yonasan's son. Now, what is the relationship between Yonasan's children and David? Yonasan's children are David's...
What? They're not related by
his wife's
because Dov is married to Yonasan's sister.
Right.
So Yonasan's sons are David's nieces and nephews. How does Dov not know where they are? They've been hiding from him. They would be wrong in hiding from him, because David always had intentions to help them. But they're playing it safe, because when a new king rises, right, usually the old king's family, whether you're the Romanovs or wherever you are usually, they're usually hiding. Maybe they'll find an Anastasia or something like that that actually survived the purge, but generally, they hide. Now, you see earlier in Shmuel Aleph that the Amaleki kid in chapter 1 thinks that David is going to be thrilled with the news that Shaul is dead. And here are his bracelets and here is his crown. But it's not. Rechav and Baana in chapter 4 are sure that David is going to reward them handsomely for presenting the head of the son of his enemy. David hacks them to death. Right? These people would be wrong in assuming that David behaves this way, but it just underscores the point that seems to be, in the eyes of some people in our book, expected behavior of the king of the new dynasty. So that these kids would be wrong. Apparently, there's only one of them. This kid named Mephibosheth is wrong in thinking that David would kill him if he presented himself. Adrabba. David volunteers the statement. Let me try to find a son of Yonasan that I can keep my word of looking after him. So here's the question, and now we can get back to chapter 6, 7, and 8. Why here? Why now? So on one level, it could be, well, the same reason why David wants to build a temple. He's been very busy with things until now, and now he's starting to, things are starting to loosen up. So he says, okay, let me see what's on my agenda. Oh, look at that. I have a free half hour. Oh, you know, maybe I can, let me see if I can, okay. So it could be.
Could be that he hadn't consolidated his rule sufficiently. Maybe he's afraid that some of the people will then back this new son of Yonatan.
And that does show up a little later during Avshalom's revolt.
Yeah.
I saw in some of Farshim it says that when David evaluated how successful his kingdom was, and he has all these people helping him run the affairs of the state, he started to feel bad about Shaul and Shaul's how quickly Shaul's kingdom just crumbled, and it reminded him, you know, I owe something to Shaul's legacy. Let me see if there's something I could do for a descendant of his.
Uh-huh.
Right. If that is the connection to chapter 8, I think there's a much stronger connection to chapter 7. Because at the end of chapter 7, God tells David, you can't build me this house, but your son will. Which got him thinking, oh my goodness, the son of my father-in-law was my dear best friend. Uh-huh. Nothing ever came of him. He should have been king. Right?
Mm-hmm.
He was worthy to be king. So that got David thinking, what can I do for Yonah's son? Okay? So, okay, we've answered all our questions so far. What made David think to do this now? And why wasn't Mephibosheth, David's own nephew, clear and present and available to him, right? So the answer to the question of how this person came to be presented to David is right here. It says, Ulaveis Shaul Eved Ushmot Siva. Vayikru lo el David, vayomer hamelech elav, ha'atot tziva, vayomer avdecha. A servant of Shaul named Tziva presented himself to David, and David asked him, I would like to do some chesed to the house of Shaul. And I heard you may know if some that I can do this for. And he told him that, yes, Yonah's son has a son named Mephibosheth who is crippled. Okay. Now, we already were told in chapter 4 how he became crippled. Do you remember?
No.
When he was a little baby and Shaul's family were being wiped out by the Philistines, a nursemaid whisked him away. He was an infant, maybe a few weeks old, and dropped him. And he broke his legs. And he could. They were in such a rush just to survive and to hide that his legs couldn't be set properly, and he grew crippled. Okay? It's not Medrash, that's what's written in the text. Okay? So David sent for Mephibosheth, who appears before David in Pasuk Vav. Let's read it. Vayavo Mephibosheth ben Yonasan ben Shaul el David, vayipol al panav vayishtachu. Very curt kind of conversation. Okay. By the way, Shaul had a son named Mephibosheth also, Shmuel Aleph. That means that Shaul had a son and a grandson with the same name. David had a daughter and a granddaughter with the same name. He had a daughter named Tamar, and his son Avshalom had a daughter named Tamar. Okay, so David speaks to him. Yemelo David, Al Tira. Now, when someone has to say to someone, "Don't be afraid," what does that obviously mean?
There's something to be afraid of.
There's something that the person thinks he should be afraid of.
Right.
All right. Which in this case is a new king, with every good reason to take vengeance on the previous king. Right? It says, Al tira, ki aso ha'aseim ha'chesed b'avur Yehonah son avicha. Not because of your grandfather, but because of your father. V'ashivosi l'cha es kol sedei Shaul avicha, v'ata tocha lechem ha'shulchan itamid. I'm going to return all of the property that belonged to your father. Right? The king gets, probably had quite a bit of land. Now, Shaul was from Shevet Binyamin. Right? And Binyamin straddles the Jerusalem area, you know. Right? I'm going to give you some landmarks now in Jerusalem area, which probably most of you recognize. Can you think of the area called, no surprise here, Givat Shaul? When you come in from Tel Aviv on Highway 1 and you see the sign that says Bruchim Habayim. Right, you come, if you go straight up, you're going to go in right into the central bus station, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you make a right onto Rehov Herzl, right, a little to the right there is that big Angel Bakery factory, right? So that's the area where Shaul had his property. Okay, that's far enough away from Ir David. It's close enough too, but it's if you're crippled. You know, and you're offered to come to the king's palace anytime you want, you know, it's still pretty far. You know, it's not easy for a cripple to travel, but okay. So David says, here is your land. It's yours. I'm going to give you a staff to look after you. And you can come to my table anytime you want. That's very nice. Very magnanimous of David. Vayishtachu vayomer ma'avdecha kifanisa ela kelev hamesa shekamoni. Who am I? This dead dog that you turn to me this way. By the way, the dog in the ancient world was a sign of subservience when people used the terminology one with the other. We found a trove of letters, Ugaritic, Akkadian, that people signed their letters when they're writing to someone in much higher status that they're hoping for. Some kind of a good response. They write the letter your dog, you know, and they write their name. Okay, we have it. It's the Goliath looks at David who doesn't respect him. He by not coming out with any armor. And he says, am I a dog that you come to me just like this, right? I'm going to feed your flesh to the animals, right? Okay, so that is, you know, a dog has become very subservient to man. It's an interesting thing. Yerushalmi in Masechet Shabbos says, you're not allowed to feed animals that don't belong to you on Shabbos, because you may come to hunt them. But you're allowed to feed a dog, even if it doesn't belong to you, because we have spoiled them. We have ruined them. The dog will die on its own. Right? Its cousin, the wolf, knows how to get its food, but the dog will not. Cat, you leave a cat out by itself, it will find what it needs. It will eat whatever it has to. But the dog won't. So because we've ruined the dog in our service, so we're allowed to feed them on Shabbos because they may die if you don't. As if though all dogs belong to us or something like that. I don't know. Anyway, so he says, what are you doing that I am this dog that you should favor me this way? I have given to the son of your master you served Yonasan. I have given to the son of your master whatever belonged to Shaul. It's very magnanimous. He put 35 people on Mephibosheth's staff. Tziva's 15 sons and 20 servants. Whatever they need so many servants for, whatever they were producing, crops, whatever it is. All 35 are now conscripted into the service of Mephibosheth. Tziva is probably from this very day plotting his chance to get even, to plotting his way.
Who was?
Tziva, this person put in charge, was put in charge of serving Mephibosheth.
Oh.
Plotting his way of pushing out Mephibosheth where he can take over. You'll see. I gave you a little sort of a heads up. Okay. So David tells him, you and your staff are now working for him. Tziva is very honorable, speaks to David in third person. Right? And David says, I want, you should always to make the point that Mephibosheth can sit at my table like one of my own sons. Beautiful. That's probably preferable for Tziva. I'd rather he eat from David's table than I have to serve him. Right? But it's probably not easy for Mephibosheth to make his way from Givat Shaul all the way up to Ir David. Right? Then it says, Ul Mephibosheth ben Katan, Ushmo Micha. Mephibosheth himself had a son, young son, and his name was Micha. V'chom Moshav Beis Tziva Avadim leMephibosheth. Everyone in the household of Tziva were now servants, subservient to Mephibosheth. The text does not tell us what the relationship was between Tziva and Mephibosheth. We can only guess that when it's going to come up, I'd say about 2 months from now, when we're in the middle of Avshalom's revolt, where these two characters appear again. Okay? And it says at the end of the chapter, Mephibosheth, Yoshev Yerushalayim, Ki al Shulchan HaMelech Tamid Hu Ochel, Hu Biseach Shtei Raglav. Right? So we see that he actually chose that option. Okay? He was a constant and very common guest at David's table. Right? You can get invited to the president's Hanukkah party, you should go. Right? You get invited to the king's palace, you should go. Okay. These two chapters seem to be filled with minutiae. you know, who helps him run the show, and right, and what, how he kept his promise to Yonasan. But it shows that David is concerned with minutia. I mean that in a good way. But David wants to make sure that things don't fall through the cracks in his kingdom, right? And he succeeds beyond any measure. And his problems don't really start in chapter 11. They start in chapter 10. And he's going to see some very interesting give and take in the commentaries and the Midrashim and the Mefarshim. There's a chapter in my book called Conflict Resolution in the Early Prophets. So I have a chapter in the book about this violation of Torah, if you will, that David sends a peace delegation to the Ammonites. Uh-oh. The Torah says, Lo tidrosh lishlomam b'tovasam adolam. You're not allowed to send any peace to the Ammonites. Right?
Right.
And here is David sending peace to the Ammonites. And it's in this I'm just giving you an introduction now because I want to do this next week. But it didn't go well. David ended up going to war over this. So a small sin became a big sin because it's at that war that David saw Bathsheba. If this war wasn't fought, then there would never have been a story of Bathsheba. Okay. Now, in David's defense, I just want to introduce you to a sefer. It's called the Sefer Yerayim. Sefer Yerayim, Rabbi Lazar of Metz, M-E-T-Z. Rabbi Lazar of Metz. He wrote a sefer outlining the 613 mitzvahs of the Torah and descriptions about the mitzvahs. Okay, he lived after the Rambam, but before the Sefer Achinuch. Okay, and Rabbi Lazar of Metz in mitzvah number 250 says that it's forbidden to a Jew, but it's the king who's the one who performs this or violates it. Like, you can be friends with an Ammonite, and you can even sign a peace pact with an Ammonite, an agreement. What you shouldn't do is to have an official governmental pact with Ammonites. Now, we don't know who the Ammonites are anymore. Today, they occupy it's occupied by Jordan, and they even have a city called Amman. But be it as it may, it says in the Torah, do not seek their peace. Lo tidrosh lishlomam. David wasn't seeking their peace. If you medaktik in the beginning of chapter 10, it says David was returning a gesture of peace, and that's where we will start next week in Mitzvah Hashem. Okay, with David extending peace, message of peace to the Ammonites, does not go well. And we'll see what the Mefarshim have to say about that. Some very interesting statements made in the poskim and the Mefarshim about what David did here. Okay, everybody have a wonderful evening.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Yaakov, welcome back.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Rabbi Adele, Paul.
Take care.
Paul, look forward to this Kiddush, this Shabbos, Paul. Mitz Hashem. Rabbi Charlie, Leon.
Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Quick question, although it may be not a quick answer, so you'll do it at another point in time. It's off topic. I was seeing something about the dearth of archaeological finds in most of Israel. And what does one, how does one take that?
I mean, well, it depends what you mean by dearth. I mean, if you go look through the entire corpus of Biblical Archaeological Review, there's plenty of material. I mean, but if you're looking for archaeological material to prove the Tanakh, it's an exercise in futility. Trying to prove Tanakh from archaeology, you can just as easily disprove Tanakh from archaeology. They're trying to prove it. They're trying to give evidence. Evidence of some things in Tanakh. So that's, none of this bothers me. First of all, you never know what's going to happen, what's going to come next.
Right.
There's this great big dig in Beit Shemesh now, and they're finding such amazing things there. Right. Plus, earthquakes and other things and floods can destroy a lot of the evidence.
Do we have indisputable archaeological evidence of the first temple? Haven't we gotten down to the stones?
Yes, we have coins. We have found pieces of pottery with names. There's a list of
from the first temple.
Very odd names. Yes, that appears in the pasuk in Yirmiyahu. Usually when we find those things, that even the New York Times gets in on it and writes about it.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay.
Have a wonderful week.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you, Rabbi.